Here in the Holy Roman Empire, we hold our great Confederation's values close to our hearts. Loving God, going to church, praising Jesus Christ, tying the Pope's shoelaces together when he's not looking, and then he gets up and then he trips, and then we all laugh because we don't like that guy. If you want to have any hope at all of preserving this sacred way of life, vote for me to be your next Holy Roman Emperor. Like you, I grew up in a nation whose borders changed up to 3 times a day under our esoteric succession laws and constant dynastic feuding that has become a normal part of life in the Holy Roman Empire. At this point, nobody really knows how many states there are in this thing. I mean, Babenhausen? Nickenich? Waldburg-Wolfegg? Tecklenburg? You can't possibly expect me to believe that these are real places. Under my rule, we will finally bring the endless bureaucracy to an end. However, we must also unite against threats from within. Every day in Rome, the Vatican fat cats spend their time eating exotic presentations of unusual birds. I'm talking about swans, peacocks, and even owls. I'm pretty sure the Bible says that's not allowed. Not that those swine know anything about the Bible, since, well, you, a hard-working citizen, are praying and farming the day away. The Pope and his menagerie of greasy clergy are spending your tithes on fine robes and performances from acrobats who can do things with their bodies that are displeasing to the Lord. As Holy Roman Emperor, I will bring this papal madness to an end. I will elect 3 or maybe 4 anti-popes and initiate the world's first pope-off. Taking place in a closed steel cage, only one pope will emerge alive. He will be crowned the true pope and guarantee that the leaders of our church never grow complacent again. Aren't ready to put your faith in me yet? Here are some testimonies from my subjects in the great land of Limpurg-Schmiedelfeld, of which I am currently the great leader.
Oh, I remember it clear as day. One day, a local vagrant came along at the town centre and started playing music to entertain the children. Ratbo the Bald had him disemboweled.
Oh yes, well, there was the time that my neighbour's horse pooed in my lawn. Ratbald the Bald found the culprit and had both him and his horse disemboweled. There was that time that my sister fell in a bog. Ratbald the Bald pulled her out with a big rope. Of course, the bog was on his land, so he did later have her disemboweled, but what are you gonna do?
That's right. Sick of your empire being run by rats? Vote for Ratbald the Bald. I will take the rats and make them bald. So then they will be ashamed and then they will scurry away and hide wherever the little rats go to hide because they will be scared of me and I will be the Holy Roman Emperor and everyone will cower beneath my iron fist. And then they will say, thank you, Ratbald, for making those rats so bald and scared. And then I will say, you're welcome, my benevolent subjects. I am your fearless leader, and you are so lucky you voted for me, because now you are.
The feast is o'er. Now brimming wine in lordly cup is seen to shine before each eager guest. And silence fills the crowded hall, as deep as when the herald's call thrills in the loyal breast.
Welcome back to the Weird Medieval Guys podcast. I'm Olivia, and this is Aaron, a robber baron in my empire.
Hello, everyone.
Ooh, that is uncanny.
I was trying not to do a fruity German accent, because you know that's what I usually do.
Yes, it's true. Well, we are a famously fruity people.
Drinking fruit cider.
And today we will be plucking the ripe fruit of Holy Roman Empire history and devouring it, which is to say podcasting about it.
Because if you know anything about the Holy Roman Empire, you know about one quote, one line in particular from the French philosopher Voltaire in the 18th century, who very famously said of the Holy Roman Empire,
"The Holy Roman Empire was neither Holy Roman nor an empire."
Wow, Olivia, that was such a good, authentic French accent. I can't believe it only took you one take.
All right, all right.
But I think that the important thing to note about that one quote is that it is widely accepted as fact, but is actually quite a contentious statement to make, I would say.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it says a lot about the society that we live in, that when I spend the whole day at home smoking cigarettes and drinking wine, just kind of making stuff up off the top of my head, people say, Olivia, get a job. But if you're French and you do it in the 18th century, people are like, wow, this guy completely revolutionized modern thinking.
You founded an intellectual tradition.
Exactly. This is like a quote that you hear everywhere. And it is always said with this kind of weirdly, like, snide.
Yes, it's always sneering. Well, did you know that the Holy Roman Empire is not the Holy...
But if you dig down into what, first of all, Voltaire actually meant when he said that, and what people mean when they're saying it, we'll find that it doesn't actually reflect very well what the Holy Roman Empire looked like for the majority of its existence.
Yeah, because the Holy Roman Empire, to take a step back, reading about it, it almost feels like historians are sort of in a competition about how vague they can be when trying to use a descriptive noun about it. It's a state, or maybe it's a political entity.
It's an idea.
It's a vibe. And so the question of what actually is the Holy Roman Empire is something that I think is very poorly understood in sort of contemporary popular history. And so what we're going to try and do is respond to Voltaire and answer the question, what the hell is the Holy Roman Empire?
In order to do so, we'll just be talking through a little bit of the historical background as to why this weird, I think the word you used, Aaron, was contraption.
Yes.
This weird contraption came to be in the first place. How it developed, how it actually functioned in practice, what role it played in Europe, and what some of the complicating factors were that made it a very cumbersome entity and a difficult concept to grapple with.
Yeah, to be honest, visually, when I'm trying to sort of imagine the sort of Platonic idea of the Holy Roman Empire, what I do keep coming back to is actually Howl's Moving Castle. This sort of enormous, clanking, incoherent nightmare of a thing that somehow, against all the odds, actually works.
Yeah, where you're kind of liable to open a door and just discover something that's got a life of its own and is doing its own thing, and you just kind of close the door and say, I'll assume I only need to worry about that once it becomes an issue.
Yeah. So to answer the question of what the Holy Roman Empire is, first we have to explain a little bit about what happened to the first Roman Empire. So, as you probably know, in the 5th century, the Roman Empire, the entity that had been ruling most of Central and Southern Europe for hundreds and hundreds of years, lost control of its western half.
Just like most of my high school experience, it got ruined by Goths.
What happened to the Western Roman Empire and why it collapsed is a tome after tome after tome sort of question rather than a single podcast sort of question. But the salient point is that political authority in the Western half of the empire essentially disintegrated. The empire obviously continues in the eastern provinces centered on Constantinople, and we'll get back to them in a minute. But what's salient to note is that the collapse of Roman authority left an opening for political entrepreneurs, shall we say. So small level, local warlords, chieftains, kings, etc., to establish relatively small-scale little kingdoms. And many of these kingdoms, especially in Central Europe, were ruled by Germanic peoples. So although there were sporadic attempts by the sort of rump Roman Empire centered in Constantinople to retake the western provinces, and there were cases of that being successful, specifically in, like, Italy, under the Emperor Justinian and his successors, Western Europe was essentially left to do its own thing. The papacy were still hanging out in Rome, but Rome is no longer a political center of any much note. And the real powers in the area are this constellation of small, constantly sort of metastasizing and changing and exchanging kingdoms. And that's essentially the status quo, more or less, until the late 8th century, when in this mosaic of local petty kingdoms, we get the emergence of one of the most sort of famous characters in early medieval history.
Charlemagne.
Charles the Man.
Carolus Magnus. Yeah, so we won't get too much into the nitty-gritty of how power crystallized in specific ways and with specific people. And it's also worth noting that at the same time, there is another influence sweeping across Europe, and that is Christianity. And so we have groups of people converting to Christianity, and we have this idea of monarchs kind of trying to unite their people under Christianity, and that this could be a unifying factor on this scattered, fragmented Europe that we're now seeing. And so eventually, one regional warlord, one king, not Charlemagne at the time, but just Charles, the Frankish king, sweeps down essentially from Germany and goes on a conquering mission, annexes the Lombard kingdom, and essentially the results of these conquests is the creation of the largest empire in Europe since the fall of Rome. This is around the year 800.
Yeah, I think it's worth touching very briefly on the sort of the nature of power in Charles's kingdom, or as we'll call it, the Carolingian Empire, which is that the Carolingian Empire is like Rome in that it's big and it's an empire, which contains many different peoples. But unlike Rome, it has no sort of central bureaucratic state. What essentially it is just a collection of places that happen to have Charlemagne as king. And so it is not a very rational entity. There's no real attempt to impose a Carolingian identity on people.
I think, and correct me if I'm wrong here, I think one of the hallmarks of the Roman Empire was that when territory was annexed, someone from Rome, from the innards of the Roman Empire, would be sent there to be an overseer, basically, and to be in charge and be a delegate and a ruler on behalf of the central Roman state. Whereas after the dissolution of Rome's power in Western Europe, empires or kingdoms just didn't essentially have the ability to exert this kind of control. Mm. And so what we saw under Charlemagne's reign was a series of kingdoms that had sworn fealty to him, where the original leadership was essentially still in place. And so it was still a group of people being led by their original ruler. There's just also an understanding that there's a bigger guy as well.
Yeah, and this is something that I should say that is common across Europe at this point, because you're seeing the emergence of countries like that you recognize, like England and Scotland and France. And in all of these places, you see the same system of power basically delegated to local elites rather than any kind of attempt to impose a rational political structure. And that's why a lot of these kingdoms are quite short-lived. And the ones that have lasted that long are pretty impressive.
Yes.
So to understand how Charlemagne is able to establish that authority over that much territory and sort of build his empire so efficiently, you have to understand a very important thing about Frankish political culture. The Franks are the people which Charlemagne comes from, and which and the kingdom of the Franks is the kingdom that his family ruled. And the important thing to understand is that they didn't practice a system of primogeniture. So they didn't have a system whereby when the old king dies, the new king is automatically the firstborn son of the previous king. No, they did something much, much, much stupider.
Can't make it too easy.
Which is that they would split their kingdom evenly between sons, or sorry, between any legitimate heirs, if there was more than one, which meant basically that they would balkanize their own kingdom every generation or so. If a king had more than one legitimate heir, which, remember, in a kingdom, you really do want to have an heir and a spare.
Yes.
It is the, that is the aspiration. Having just one is way too dangerous. If you had more, so if you had more than one, you would have to split up the entire kingdom, just cut it down the middle. And quite a lot of the time, this meant that if one of the sons dies, the remaining sons will have to fight over that son's territory, which means, almost inevitably, either at best political chaos or at worst civil war.
Well, yeah, because even though we've established that this isn't a time in Europe that's bureaucratically intense, to put it one way, it's still, I would say, an administrative burden just dividing an empire or a kingdom up. And so it creates this just massive sense of instability, I would say, when you have these kingdoms getting constantly divided up. I mean, in theory, you would think, oh, this would lead to a series of increasingly smaller and smaller kingdoms in Europe. But actually, this was one of the main catalysts for the uniting of one larger empire, because once, you know, you have this instability created by a big tract of land, a big kingdom being chopped in half, that actually makes it really easy to just go in, take the new king unawares, especially if you're, say, his brother, and essentially just take over. So that's one of the things Charlemagne does when his brother dies. He goes in and says, well, this is my land now. Sorry. And then he keeps going.
And I should say, it's important to remember that, like, for a small kingdom to be able to survive, they need to have political stability. And if you don't have that, yeah, it is just much easier to conquer whole tracts of land if new real estate is popping up every generation or so. And that's why, yeah, kingdoms tend to be quite short-lived. So, for example, you may remember all the way back in, I think, episode 6, when we talked about the kingdom of Lotharingia and dilettante idiot king, Lothar.
Yep.
Lothar II. Kingdoms like that are very short-lived and unstable for exactly this reason.
Yeah, because we saw Lothar basically without a legitimate heir. He was in massive trouble. He
poured
was in hot
Berga.
Water. Yes, he tried to divorce his wife several times, but his wife's family wouldn't let him, and he had all of these hangers-on, his uncles and his brothers, I think, who were essentially just waiting for things to get unstable enough that they could sweep in. And so they did.
Speaking of Lothar and Teutberga, we talked before about how great Frankish names are, but I just want to reiterate that. So in the first couple of generations of the Holy Roman Empire, you get some incredible epithets. So you have Charles the Fat, Louis the Stammerer, Louis the Child, and Charles the Bald. And you also have amazing first names. So Louis the Child's brothers were called Zventibald and Rattled.
Yes, I mean, Ratbald wasn't one that I made up for that cold open. No. That was a legitimate name. Rat means still in modern German, like law, essentially, and or rule, and bald meant bold. And so, yeah.
You bold law.
Absolutely amazing names.
They all sound like supporting characters from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
And it's funny because a lot of the names that existed back then are still in use today, like Wilhelm and, you know, Edward. These are also names of the same time and place. And it is just, I would say, kind of a random chance that we have people today who are still named Frederick, but we don't have anyone named, you know,
Zwentable.
Exactly.
Name your firstborn child Ratbald.
And we will allow them to feature on the podcast.
By the way, if you're not following any of this, that's fine. The early medieval period is very confusing, there's too many kings, and everybody has the same goddamn name. So, by the end of the 8th century, Charlemagne is the king of the Franks. He's amassed the largest empire since the fall of Rome. He is the most powerful figure in Northern European politics. But he is not yet the emperor. And to explain how he gets that title, we have to return to a thing that you mentioned very briefly at the start, which is that he sweeps down south and knocks out the kingdom of the Lombards. The Lombards are this Germanic people who settled in the Po Valley of northern Italy. So sort of south of the Alps, north of Rome. Now, the Lombards had been harassing for generations the city of Rome and the papacy in particular. The Pope is, at this stage, I'd say, not a very powerful figure in European sort of political life. He's just sort of camping out in this slightly wrecked city of Rome, looking for a new patron. Rome, as I mentioned before, hasn't, by the start of the 9th century, hasn't been within the sort of reach of the still extant Byzantine Empire for many generations at this point. And so the Pope is basically without a patron. But then...
But then...
along comes Charlemagne, and the Pope agrees, as a sort of thank you very much for defeating the Lombards and eliminating this threat, agrees to crown Charlemagne as Emperor of the Romans. Now, as we've been alluding to up to this point, there already is an Emperor of the Romans, and the Pope has up to this point recognized that emperor in Constantinople as very much still the Emperor of Rome, even if he doesn't have the political authority to control Italy. So how on earth does the Pope justify just basically taking this bauble that belongs to the emperor in Constantinople and giving it to this random sweaty German guy?
Well, he is still, at the end of the day, the Pope. He's the central authority in Christianity in Europe. And at the end of the day, even though he can't necessarily, at this point, raise an army or force any, you know, kings to do his bidding, having the approval of the Pope, especially because this idea is developing that rulers are chosen by God and have a divine right to rule, having the Pope, who's the central authority in Christianity, say, that's right, and God wants this guy specifically to rule, that is actually a pretty big deal, and it is going to convince people that you have some legitimacy. And on the other hand, for the Pope, being able to give that out, of course, very carefully, very sparingly, as a token of goodwill, that's going to be very good for him, because that gives the Pope a little bit of control.
Absolutely, and I would add to that, in terms of, like, why it matters to be emperor, I would add to that what it means for Charlemagne, which is it gives a sense of rationality to this enormous empire that he has. Because, again, this is not a, this has been up to this point this sort of, like, basically dynastic union, this sort of collection of smaller kingdoms and principalities that sort of happen to be under his dominion. If he can say, no, I rule all these different nations and peoples that are incredibly different, even though they're not that different, they're just different kinds of Germans. even if I rule all these disparate peoples, I'm doing that because I'm the divinely chosen emperor of Rome. It gives you a sense of legitimacy that that state has never had before.
Yes, and we've talked about this before on the podcast, the idea that's not unique to the Middle Ages, the idea that's common to most of recorded human history, that legitimacy is based on precedent. If you can say this is how it was before, then you can say it should be the same way now. And contrary to popular belief, people living in the early Middle Ages, you know where I'm going with this, hadn't forgotten about the classical worlds. It wasn't just chaos and barbarians and mudmen fighting each other with clubs. No, people were extremely aware that they were living in the shadow of the Roman Empire, and they didn't see themselves as the post-Roman age. They essentially saw themselves as, you know, temporarily embarrassed imperial subjects, or however you want to call it.
Yeah. If early medieval Europe is a somewhat post-apocalyptic environment, just because there's no longer that sort of central state to impose order, it's not Mad Max out there. It's really sort of, it's more a New California Republic, to make my second Fallout reference in two episodes.
Well, yeah, I mean, people, it's hard to know when you're living through the end of something, because the end doesn't happen quickly. Case in point, are we living through the end right now? We'll probably know in 100 years.
Yeah. Well, we won't.
You know,
there's... somebody will.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, and you've seen within the previous two centuries, like the expansion and the contraction of the Roman Empire in the East to, you know, grab Italy and then lose Italy again. Like, it's not necessary. Like, it's not gone. The past is still there.
And of course, this need to seize upon the legitimacy of the Roman Empire, this kind of latent legitimacy that's waiting there to be picked up on, this is an emerging need because, as we've said before, there was still a Roman Empire in the East. The problem is that this Roman Empire is becoming increasingly alienated from the West, from Rome.
Yeah, and the real sort of break point where Western Europe ditches the legitimacy of the Eastern Roman Empire comes during the reign of that very rare thing in Roman history, an empress. In the late 8th century, there was the Empress Irene of Athens, who was, you know, she came from this sort of very powerful, wealthy Greek family in Attica, and she married into the imperial family. She married Emperor Leo IV, and she was elevated to empress and bore him a son. Now, she was empress consort for 12 years until 780, when Leo died, leaving her as regent for her young son. Now, this instantly made her the most powerful empress in Roman history, vastly more powerful even than Theodora of Justinian and Theodora, because she's basically ruling alone. And she was... this was not received very well, I should say, by the Roman elite, who pretty much immediately tried to coup her and failed. Then, later on, her son tried to depose her and assume personal rule, and she had his eyes gouged out.
It sounds to me, and you can tell me if I'm misinterpreting this, but what I'm getting from this is that they hated to see a girl boss winning.
They literally did, and that is very much a theme of this story. It gets worse for girl bosses. So, after her son died, she ruled alone. And very importantly, she didn't rule alone as a consort or as a regent. She ruled as the empress. She signed her decrees as basileus, which is the Greek term for emperor. Not empress, a female emperor. Now, this was utterly scandalous in Europe, as you can imagine, because I don't know if you guys know this. This might make me a bit of a woke SJW, but 8th century Europe was pretty misogynistic. But it also allowed the Pope and Charlemagne to argue that because Irene was a woman, she obviously couldn't be emperor, which meant that there was a vacancy in Constantinople, which meant that the Pope was empowered to choose a new emperor. And so on Christmas Day in the year 800, Charlemagne is crowned Emperor of the Romans, and the Holy Roman Empire is born.
Yes, so this isn't an unprecedented move, right? Because the Pope already is the person who crowns the emperor to begin with, right?
Yeah, as the sort of, yeah, so the question of what role the Pope has in sort of in secular politics in Western Europe is very, very, very complicated and very, very contentious. But basically, by the 8th and 9th centuries, that is the authority that the popes were able to claim.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's a recurring theme we'll see over the course of this story, that the papal approval is extremely important for a ruler to have. To the extent that if one doesn't have it, it's easier to get a new pope than it is to carry on without a pope who says, yes, you are the emperor, you are legitimate.
Yeah, so I think that gets to the heart of what this moment on Christmas Day 800 really means, which is it is the kind of really awkward fusing of these two worlds, you know, the central Italian sort of religious establishment and the Germanic kind of secular rulers, that is going to become more and more and more unstable over the next 500-600 years. And it's very interesting, I think, that in 802, there is actually an effort to get Irene, who is very much single and ready to mingle, married off to Charlemagne, an act that would have united these kind of these two empires, and successfully, in many ways, reconstructed most of the sort of former Roman Empire, except the somewhat parochial elites in Constantinople said, I have no interest in moving to Aachen and being the busybody of this smelly German. And so they had Irene deposed and she had to flee. And 'twas never to be, but it's interesting to think about what could have happened if they'd actually just stuck the landing.
Alternate history video YouTube makers, take note.
Finally, they can make a video that's not what if the South won the war or what if the Nazis won the war.
Exactly. What if the Holy Roman Empire had conquered California? God, I wish. But I think we can, insofar as we can presume to know someone from 1200 years ago, I think we can imagine that Charlemagne himself is hopeful because he is a guy who has belief that he can restore some semblance of the former greatness that's been lost. He is a guy who wants to bring back classical scholarship and classical learning. Again, to describe this as a time after the fall of the Roman Empire is extremely anachronistic because... This is kind of, for Charlemagne, this is just like, oh, we're getting back into it.
Yeah, it's like, okay, we're back. We were so, it was so over, and now we're so back.
Yep. And so when this empire of all this land that Charlemagne controls, so this is most of Central Europe.
Yeah, it's basically Germany, a little bit of Eastern France, and Italy.
And the bits in between, like the Czech Republic and Austria.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's sort of, it's basically, you can imagine this sort of like column stretching down the length of central continental Europe.
Yeah, and bring it back. It being classical learning, scholarship, cultures, and values, Charlemagne most certainly tries to do. So his reign as emperor marks the beginning of what's known today as the Carolingian Renaissance. So there's this period of time where there's a pretty widespread throughout the empire revival of interest in classical studies. And this wasn't just because they, like most people after the fall of Rome, were huge weeaboos for Rome. Wolfaboos, I guess. It was also a massively practical concern because Latin was increasingly becoming really weird and hard to understand. And the people in what's now France had their own weird dialect, and the people in what's now Italy had a different weird dialect, and don't get me started on Spain and Romania. And so all of these people who spoke this weird intermediate form of language between Latin and what are now modern French, Spanish, and other Romance languages couldn't understand each other, and that was scary. And not only that, they couldn't understand the Bible. There were priests fully walking around not knowing what was in the Bible, which was a little bit uncomfortable for rulers at the time as well, because that's probably something a priest should be able to do.
Yeah, what if the priest says, oh yeah, it's fine to worship idols. And then guess what? Your entire congregation goes to hell.
Exactly.
Because priests can't read.
So Charlemagne says, okay, we need to sort this out. We need to make sure everyone knows Latin. And he sets up a series of schools within the empire that are basically geared to do exactly this, to make people fluent in what's known as Vulgar Latin, a bit pejoratively, but is essentially the Latin of the late Roman Empire.
So it's not just Latin with a few more F words in it.
Exactly, in which the Bible is written.
R-rated Latin.
And so he basically makes it the clergy's business to go to these schools to learn the Latin that they need, and to do so he imports teachers from all around Europe, especially from
Constantinople?
No.
Oh, fuck.
Ireland. So the Irish had just gotten done turning all of the English people into Christians, and Charlemagne was like, I love your work. Can you turn my Christians back into Christians? And brings a bunch of Irish people. One of Charlemagne's biographers said, and I quote, that he held a special regard for the Irish. There was a story that I read of two Irish monks who allegedly arrived in France in what was at the time the Holy Roman Empire and set up a stall in a market to preach their beliefs and their wisdom. And Charlemagne caught wind of this and said, guys, come on down to my court so you guys can be my court Irish monks.
It was all very sort of easy breezy back then. That was the sort of thing that could happen to you.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if that story has been verified, but I think it gives a sense of the fact that the Holy Roman Empire became the center of gravity in Christendom. And Charlemagne and his efforts and those of his successors did manage to standardize Latin. What we now know as ecclesiastical Latin can be attributed to this period of time. They also invented a new kind of handwriting for writing Latin, which made it easy for everyone across Europe to understand the handwriting. This is also super interesting because this form of handwriting was eventually superseded by Gothic, so that really fancy, really difficult to read script. But later on, this type of handwriting, called Carolingian minuscule, was rediscovered by humanist scholars in the 15th and 16th centuries, who saw it and thought that they were looking at the writing of the ancient Greeks and Romans. I've talked about this before. Yeah. This is one of my favorite facts. But actually, they were looking at early medieval handwriting. And they said, oh, this must be the handwriting of, you know, the learned societies of the classical world. And so they adopted it, turned it into something called humanist script, which was then picked up by printers and turned into fonts that were the precursors of basically all of our modern typefaces, like Times New Roman. So the Carolingian. Exactly. Yes.
A body.
Exactly. Papyrus. No, just kidding. Everyone knows the ancient Egyptians invented that one. So yeah, these Carolingian schools, as they were called, basically invented modern writing, which is super cool. The modern Latin alphabet. And they also created a whole artistic movement of like very naturalistic Roman-inspired artworks and Roman-inspired architecture. There's all sorts of classical architectural styles dotted across Central Europe that are really, really difficult to distinguish to the untrained eye from Roman architectural styles. So this was this massive uptick in conscious awareness and imitation of the Roman Empire. That doesn't mean that this was a complete break from the past.
No.
Classical scholarship had still been alive and well in Europe before this. So again, what we often hear referred to as the Dark Ages was not a time of complete ignorance of Roman and Greek learning. It was a time when there was definitely instability, but because of this, scholars were desperately scrabbling to try to keep hold of everything they had from the classical world. And it was really, really the big difference was that the Holy Roman Empire was very large and was able to create a sense of widespread peace and prosperity such that scholarship was able to continue on a much broader, more interconnected scale across the continent.
The one question that I do hear, though, is if these people are so goddamn interested in imitating and resurrecting Rome, why doesn't Rome, the actual city, become the capital of the empire? And it's a well-meaning question, but I think it's also quite an anachronistic one, because the answer for why they didn't make Rome the capital is because there wasn't really a capital city in those days. That wasn't really something that an early medieval state needed. Because again, this is still an era of a low level of bureaucracy, a not very much centralized authority. Even though it is still, quote unquote, the empire. Instead, the Holy Roman Emperor was an itinerant institution. Basically, the royal court would bounce across the empire, from sort of major city to major city, and settling disputes, catching up with relatives, basically doing whatever business needed to be done in that part of the empire and then moving on. And actually, there was a really interesting paper that came out this year that sort of mapped basically every recorded imperial visit across the empire for like 1,000 years. And you see a lot of names coming up as sort of major centers worth visiting that we hear about today. So yes, Rome, but also places like Cologne and Frankfurt and Mainz that had local elites that the emperor needed to keep on side, keep them sweet, to keep the whole contraption running.
Yeah, I think another great reason to have a capital city is when you have a bunch of people who are successive rulers who are all descended from each other, because that keeps the seat of power where everyone was born, and it becomes a kind of cycle of reinforcement. This place is legitimate because we're from here. We are from here, therefore we are legitimate. But this isn't really something that's applicable in the case of the Holy Roman Empire, because we don't have these long dynasties of succession.
No, it's the Holy Roman Empire from the 10th century onwards is what is called an elective monarchy. And if that is messing with your head as a modern person, let me just take a step back and explain it to you. You know the scene in the Game of Thrones finale that everybody hates, where they vote for the new king? That they just did that every generation. So king dies, all the great nobles get together and vote on who the next king will be. And it could be anyone from any sort of major noble family. Among those sort of major noble families who would go on to hold the imperial title, you want to know who is not on that list in the Middle Ages? Probably the most famous Holy Roman Empire imperial family, the Habsburgs. They are not players. Banish the Habsburgs from your mind.
At most, you have maybe 2 or 3 people from a single line of succession who are Holy Roman Emperors.
Yeah, these are genuinely competitive elections in the medieval period. In the early modern period, the title will become a bit of a Habsburg bauble that they'll just sort of pass back and forth amongst themselves. But really, from the 10th century onwards, it becomes a genuinely open question every generation. Who the new emperor is going to be. And the reason for that is really simple. It comes back to the same exact problem that Charlemagne and the early Frankish kings are presented with, which is that royal authority, central authority, is very weak. Every time a new emperor comes along, they are going to have to, in some way or another, win over the support of a majority of the important people in the realm in order to just have a functioning state. So it makes a lot of sense to institutionalize that and formalize that through the system of elections. Elections are very good as a tool, even in non-democratic regimes. They are very good at making people build a winning coalition among the sort of the key power brokers in the country. Now, in a democracy, that means 50% plus one of the population, but in a non-democratic state, it can mean the guy who controls the taxes, the guy who controls the army, the guy who can talk to God. And it's interesting, you don't have, for most of the medieval period, until the mid-14th century, you don't really have a consistent formalization of who gets to vote for your Holy Roman Empire. You do get there. A law is passed in 1356 called the Golden Bull, which enumerates exactly what the electoral procedure is and who can vote. Would you like to know how to become a 14th century Holy Roman Emperor?
Yeah, of course I want to know the procedure that I will follow in order to become the emperor.
Ah, Ratbold, it's nice for you to join us. So, I hope you're paying attention and taking notes.
You know, bald rats exist. They breed them as pets.
Didn't need to know that. Now I do. So, Ratbold, here's the first thing you need to know. You only need the support of a majority of electors. You don't need unanimity. You just need 50% plus one. Got that?
I think so.
I thought you were in character.
I think so.
Okay. When the election happens, the electors will have 30 days within which to choose their candidate. If they don't, they will have to, and I'm quoting directly from the Golden Bull here, live upon bread and water, and shall not leave the city until the election has been decided.
I don't think that living on bread sounds so bad. In Germany, we do this every day.
Yeah, well, it's too many carbs, isn't it?
As long as the water is carbonated.
But there'll be no bratwurst. No currywurst.
Ach, du meine Güte. Das ist für mich gar nichts.
And lastly, an elector can vote for himself. Now, you're probably wondering, are you an elector? The answer is no. For most of the medieval period, the number of electors varies dramatically from election to election. But by the in the Golden Bull, the number of electors is fixed at 7. These are the Archbishop of Mainz, Trier, and Cologne, the King of Bohemia, the Count Palatinate of the Rhine, the Duke of Saxony, and the Margrave of Brandenburg. Now, what's interesting from a political science point of view is, do you notice anything about those specific persons that's interesting?
They all have different titles.
Well, yes, they're all very diverse. If I was going to put on my sort of political science hat, I'd say the reason why you're able to narrow it down to 7 is because they represent the different power blocks in the empire. So you have the archbishops representing the church. You have the German lords, and from different parts of Germany, so the Rhine and Brandenburg and Saxony, and you have the King of Bohemia, who is representative of the non-German peoples of the empire. So if you think about it in those terms, those are the people who you're going to need support from anyway, so this is just an institutionalization of the power broker wheeler dealing that any emperor would need to do.
So, you're an aspiring Holy Roman Emperor. Maybe your name is Ratbald the Bald. Maybe not. But either way...
Probably not, because he's not a real guy.
If only. But either way, you build enough consensus to win the hearts, or at least the votes, of more than half of these electors. Congratulations. Well done. So what now? What are your benefits?
Well, you are, I mean, in theory, the ruler of the universe... I mean, there is a... One of the issues with talking about the Holy Roman Empire is that, once again, the modern world has colonized our idea of what an empire is. Because in the medieval Christian understanding of the world, the empire means something very, very specific. You know, in the 19th century, we had empireflation, we had Empire Palooza, everybody wanted to be an empire.
It's true, people were actually papering their walls with empires because it was so expensive to go out and buy wallpaper.
I mean, look, you had in 1871, you had the Emperor of Russia, you had the Emperor of Austria-Hungary, you had the Emperor of Germany, you had the British monarch, who wasn't the Empress of Britain, but she was sure as shit the Empress of India, and of course, France had just gotten rid of their most recent Emperor of the French. It was harder to find yourself in a country that didn't call itself an empire in modern Europe than it was to avoid them. Whereas, again, there is not empires in medieval Christian Europe. There is the empire. This is why Empress Irene being a vacancy at the top is so important. Because it's a singular title. It's a person. because emperor, the Roman emperor has a very specific role in medieval Christianity. It's important to remember that Jesus was born and died in the Roman Empire, and for four centuries after his death, early Christians were trying to make sense of and rationalize the teachings of Jesus and of course, the Old Testament within the political framework in which they were living. So Rome ends up having an outsized influence on the development of Christianity. You can see this, for example, in the Book of Daniel, which describes there being four great empires before the end of the world, and the last of these is always assumed to be
the Roman Empire.
Yes, especially after Constantine the First sort of consecrates the Roman Empire and turns it into a functionally Christian state. From that point on, the Roman Empire becomes, in its own conception, the kingdom of heaven on earth, basically, the instrument of God's will. And the important thing to understand about God's will is that God's will is not bound territorially. God doesn't say, oh, well, I'm very involved in Germany, but I don't mess with France.
Oh, I'm pretty sure that's exactly what God thinks. No, just kidding.
God's authority is universal. And again, this is what they think. And so the empire is universal. And what this means is that, again, in its own conception of itself, the Holy Roman Empire is the empire of all Christians. There might be kings who might rule with divine authority, but their authority is of a qualitatively different level. The idea is the emperor has essentially outsourced running France to this weird guy from the House of Valois instead of doing it himself.
Yeah, I mean, I think without falling into the etymological fallacy of trying to force a word to agree with its etymology, we can talk about the origin of the word empire, which comes from the Latin imperium, which essentially just means will or control or command. And so, of course, even though the meaning of the word empire changed and eventually took on a meaning that was somewhat beyond this original sense, I do think especially because the elites of the time in the Middle Ages, whether within or without the church, would have all been Latinate. I think we can imagine that they were aware when they spoke this word of this original sense, that this was the original and the divine source of command and of control. This was, you know, essentially an instrument for God's will.
Absolutely. And this is why one absolutely crucial idea in the Holy Roman Empire and its political thought is the idea of translatio imperii. It's a hard concept to translate because it doesn't really have a natural modern analog. But like basically this idea that the office of emperor and the authority of the empire, again, this very specific divinely inspired empire, can pass from one place to another and from one civilization to another.
Bada bing, bada boom, now you are the instrument of God's will, and now you get to impose imperial rule and imperial law, because you are the Holy Roman Emperor, right?
Not really. So, the King of France didn't give a fuck what crown is on your head. If you try and, like, take his lands, he's going to say, non, mon ami.
Say not allowed.
Not to be too much of a realist about it, but like at a certain point, all this like ideological nonsense about the Book of Daniel does have to bend the knee to who has the bigger army. And quite frankly, that's not always the emperor. So the emperor does not, he has sort of some vague sense of authority, the sense that he is the first among equals among the Christian kingdoms. But that doesn't really mean very much in a practical sense. In terms of how the empire itself runs itself, the extent to which the emperor is able to dominate parts of his kingdom really depends on the context, and it depends on geography. It depends on how far away that place is. We've talked about how places in northern Italy, like Milan or Florence, were functionally, in a lot of ways, independent of the authority of the Holy Roman Empire, despite being, in theory, within it, because the Alps are big and they're hard to get around. So if a bunch of Florentine merchants are yucking it up in their city, there's not much you can do about it.
I mean, to use another pop cultural reference, it reminds me a little bit of the United Nations, because the Holy Roman Empire, clearly to people at the time, was an entity that had meaning. It had ideological weight, in the same way that if we talk about something being important, we might talk about it being a UNESCO World Heritage Site.
Yeah.
Or we might talk about the International Court of Justice as being our reference points for what's important and what common values our global society holds. But that doesn't mean that when push comes to shove, these entities are always able to enforce their own judgments or morals.
And this also comes, I think, this kind of comes a cropper of the attempt to make the Holy Roman Empire more Roman. From the 11th century onwards, there is an intellectual movement or tradition called the Glossators, who try and sort of rediscover, and I put rediscover in huge quotation marks, Roman law, mainly based on what they're discovering from these sort of fading Byzantine empires, so particularly things like the Justinianic Code, which is this huge law code compiled by the Emperor Justinian. And they take these sources, like things like the Justinianic Code and other sort of little bits of jurisprudence that they find, and they try and impose it on their own empire, and they quickly find that actually no, this is not a country of provinces and legions and generals. This is a deeply confounding, confusing feudal system of knights and counts and archbishoprics,
margraves,
and things like that.
Earls,
exactly.
Marquesses. Can you give any examples of bits of this code that they tried to implement?
Well, one very important bit, or one sort of ideal example of this coming a cropper, is the attempt to impose what they understood of Roman marriage law. So in Christian canon law, do you know what a very important part of a marriage being valid is?
Consummation.
But
a bone.
Yeah, you got to get it on before a marriage is legal. However, they found a bit of basically jurisprudence, a legal decision from ancient Rome, where this guy who drowned in the Tiber, and he had married this woman, but had never slept with her. And so the woman went to court to try and find out what sort of rights she was entitled to under Roman law. And the Roman judges ruled that she was legally married to her husband, who had drowned in the Tiber, before they could ever, you know, do their husbandly and
That's
wifely duties.
So rough, man.
Yeah. Imagine.
That sucks. The poor lady.
She thought she had a lifetime of great sex.
She probably wasn't in any rush. She said, "No, baby, you go out drinking on a riverboat with your friends. I'll be at home waiting for you. We've got all the time in the world."
And then he died. He fucking died.
Julia, you know how we were out drinking with your husband on that riverboat? Well, Claudius said, "Hey, I think I dropped my sandal in the Tiber, and it was a joke. But unfortunately, Fabianus jumped in after the sandal, and he was never seen again."
He just went blub, blub, blub.
Yeah.
Like in one of those cartoons.
I think a sturgeon got him. Anyways, see you for the funeral next week.
By the way, are you legally single now?
Yeah. Oh, I'll have to go to the courts to find out. You just stay right here. Anyways.
Anyway, so they basically, whenever something like that came up, they basically had to fudge it. And they're just like,
Yeah.
Courtly, let's let the priests figure that one out. But it was a... It was an expression of the fact that there is a disconnect now between the state's conception of itself as the direct legal successor to the Roman Empire and the ways in which society had just profoundly changed. The impact was probably more in kind of rationalizing the legal code than in actually implementing a recognizably Roman justice system.
That makes sense. I mean, that's usually how it goes, right? Oh, we found these old legal codes, and turns out they're pretty similar to our current legal codes.
This is one of the fun things about history, is you get to find out that everything old was actually invented between the years 1500 and 1900.
Yep.
We've been talking up to this point about the secular institutions of the empire, but the truth is that, as we mentioned at the start of the show, the empire is this kind of awkward marriage of the secular Frankish kingdoms and the authority of the Pope. And the truth is that over the Middle Ages, one of the things about the papacy is that it grows gradually more and more and more powerful through the increasing bureaucratization of the church, the vast amount of money that starts coming into the church through tithes, the just outrageous fraud that is the donation of Constantine that we don't have to get into. Basically, they fabricated a legal document from Emperor Constantine saying that actually the Pope runs all of Western Europe now, something that Constantine would have never, ever, ever said, because the Pope would have been just some bishop in Rome. But in any case, you have an emperor that's not all-powerful, and you have in Italy, an institution in the papacy that is growing more and more independent-minded and more able to express itself as an independent political actor. And this really comes to a head in the 1070s, under the reign of Emperor Henry IV and the papacy of Pope Gregory VII. Now, Gregory VII is a very interesting guy. I'd say he's one of my favorite guys in the Middle Ages because he has such an unusual bio for a pope. So before Gregory VII was Gregory VII, he was a guy named Hildebrand. Hildebrand was the son of a blacksmith, and when he was a young man, he went and studied at a monastery where he caught the eye of a future pope, ended up working for him, basically becoming his kind of his second in command. He gradually works his way further and further up the bureaucracy of this, again, continent-spanning, in many ways, sort of hidden empire that is the medieval church. I mean, he's a very sort of Thomas Cromwell-esque character in that he comes from a very unlikely background to rise to this very, very high position as this very powerful kind of administrator. And just like Thomas Cromwell, he's also a bit of a religious radical. After he is elected in a very contentious election that isn't really an election at all, basically just a bunch of people in Rome just sort of shout, Hildebrand should be the Pope. He comes to power and he implements sort of a very radical reforming agenda into how the medieval church works. Now, we think about the Catholic Church now as a very conservative, sort of eternal, unchanging institution. But the truth is that a lot of the core ideas of modern Catholicism were laid down in the 11th century under the papacy of Gregory VII. One of those very important ideas being that priests should not marry. Gregory was trying to do two things. He was trying to bring a more sort of standardized approach to the faith than had existed previously. And he was also trying to separate the clergy from the sinful mass of the laity. So basically normal people like you and me. But also the lay aristocracy from the lowest knight to the emperor himself. That's what not letting priests marry is all about. Another way that he wanted to sort of extricate the secular authority from the church and let the sort of the church be its own independent institution was by removing the power of secular rulers, including the emperor, to appoint bishops. Now, this is obviously not a great thing to agree to if you are the emperor, because appointing bishops is a very sort of important patronage thing that you have at your disposal to keep people sweet. It's a great thing to hang over people,
yeah,
to express your authority. And also just like, you don't want some random guy in your city saying shit about you.
I mean, we often, I think about and frame the Middle Ages in terms of a struggle for power between the church and the state. But of course, this is partially a bit disingenuous because for a lot of Christian history, the church and the state are quite incestuous.
Yes.
And actually, a lot of the power struggles come from people saying maybe these things should be less incestuous.
Yeah, and people like Gregory are very much trying to create these parallel secular and religious sort of political institutions and structures that are able to coexist independently of one another. Basically, you know, let the domain of the spiritual be separated from the sort of gross, raw politics of the material world.
But if you're a gross, raw politician, you don't like that. And Henry IV does not like this. In fact, he writes to Gregory and he says, "Stop it. That's not on."
And Gregory writes back to him, "You need to kill yourself. Now."
Essentially, yes. Yeah. I mean, he pushes, in the notes you described it as the nuclear button, which I think is the only way you can really describe it. He excommunicates him.
Yes, in one of the greatest letters of all time. So excommunication, whether or not you're a king or an ordinary person, is basically casting somebody out of the church. They can no longer receive communion. They can no longer be blessed. Their soul is damned forever. There's an extra element, though, for a ruler. If a ruler is excommunicated, then no Christian is any more obligated to follow any of their laws. It is the dissolution of their political authority. And we can see this really clearly if we read Gregory's letter of excommunication to Henry.
"For the honor and security of thy church, and the name of Almighty God, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, I withdraw, through thy power and authority, from Henry the King, the rule over the whole kingdom of the Germans and over Italy. And I absolve all Christians from the bonds of oath which they have made or shall make to him. And I forbid anyone to serve him as king. For it is fitting that he who strives to lessen the honour of thy church should himself lose the honour which belongs to him. And since he has scorned to obey as a Christian and is not returned to God who he has deserted, holding intercourse with the excommunicated, practicing manifold iniquities, spurning my commands, which, as thou dost bear witness, I issued to him for his own salvations, separating himself from thy church and striving to rend it, I bind him in thy stead with the chain of anathema. And leaning on thee, I so bind him that the people may know and have proof that thou art Peter, and above thy rock the Son of the living God hath built his church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it."
Nice.
It's pretty good, wasn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And it is the nuclear button, because this isn't something you can just do willy-nilly as the Pope. I think it's one of those things where the more you do it, probably the less seriously people will take it. But he does do it, and it is quite effective, actually, in immediately obliterating Henry's authority.
Yeah, because all the German nobles basically round on him and go like, "You need to sort this out now. I don't care."
Yeah.
That Gregory is like a cantankerous old oaf and the son of a blacksmith. You need to get your shit together and make good with him, or we're gonna kill you.
Yep.
So he does something very, very remarkable. In 1076, Gregory sails down the Rhine and then makes a journey on foot through the Alps to the castle of Canossa, seat of Matilda of Canossa, the ruler of Tuscany, who actually by coincidence happened to be one of the key sponsors of the Gloucester movement. Anyway, he arrives outside of Canossa, and he sits out there for 4 days in the dead of winter in this awful blizzard, in not even in robes, in rags, basically, doing this whole performative kind of like, oh, I'm but a mere sinner. Oh, I have erred, you know, trying to basically make good with Gregory. And eventually, after 4 days, accounts disagree on why they decided to do it, but they do let him in and they have a conversation. Nobody knows exactly how that conversation goes. All our different sources present it differently. Some say that Henry was very, very, very apologetic. Others say that it was Matilda who was sort of the key figure in kind of bridging the gap between these two men who, again, just despise each other, very obviously.
Yeah, I think it's worth mentioning that this whole song and dance of going somewhere in rags and waiting outside in repentance and being denied entry for several days, this is an established language of Christian repentance. For instance, this is something that you're supposed to do to people who wish to become monks. The abbot of the abbey should let them sit outside the walls and repent for several days and, you know, test their faith. So, yeah, I think we should assume that Gregory wasn't necessarily taken in by this show of piety. In fact, I think that they both knew that Henry was, you know, going through the motions.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that what we can probably put together is that he's going through the necessary kind of ablutions to sort of, as a precondition for negotiation.
Yes.
Because it, just as it would have been humiliating for an emperor to traipse through the mountains on foot, it would have been equally sort of weakening to the Pope's authority if he let in a guy who he had excommunicated with no, like, even performative sense of him being repentant. So anyway, at the end of the process, the excommunication is lifted, and Henry publicly sort of repents and apologizes for, you know, calling the Pope a son of a bitch. You know, I don't think that was sincere, because a few years later, Henry invades Rome and tries to have Gregory deposed.
And he succeeds, I believe.
Yeah, well, he sets up his own anti-pope.
Yes, yeah, I mean, I think Henry is excommunicated by Gregory two more times in his life, and then in response to one of these times sets up his anti-pope, which an anti-pope is essentially something that arose from this very conflict. It's not a new thing at this point. Essentially, if the Holy Roman Emperor thinks, oh, this pope who we've got right now isn't great, I don't fancy him, he doesn't fancy me, oh, thank God, I found this new guy who can be our pope, who coincidentally agrees with me and everything that I say. And whether or not this is successful kind of depends on how much support he's able to drum up for this new guy. Often it's not very much. Sometimes it's enough that it becomes unclear who is the real pope and who isn't. Although the Catholic Church kind of in retrospect has gone back and tried to decide who's who. And this wasn't a rare thing either. This happened a couple times a century, actually, for most of the Middle Ages. But during the century when this conflict was taking place, this happened around 15 times. So new anti-popes all the time. Actually, in the 15th century, there were two anti-popes and a regular pope. Real Mexican standoff. This was during the Avignon Papacy, of course. And yeah, in general, just a bit of a nuisance at best for the pope. At worst, a genuine threat. Oftentimes, once they managed to get rid of the anti-pope, he had already appointed a bunch of anti-bishops and anti-cardinals and stuff who were then running around trying to lay claim to their power. Just a generally stressful thing to have to deal with.
And this is why by the early 1300s, Rome and its sort of immediate environs basically just breaks off from the Holy Roman Empire and becomes its own thing, the Papal States, which is a story for another day, but is basically the part of central Italy that is directly ruled by the Pope and his sort of and his various cardinals. It's literally just Vatican City, but much, much, much bigger.
Yep.
What I think this speaks to is the fact that even though Henry was able to set up his own anti-pope, the fact that he was being bossed around by the Pope, I think, speaks to the weakening of the central imperial power that was already quite weak to begin with, and the growth of the papacy as an independent political actor. And you see the kind of the impact of that sort of really for the rest of the Middle Ages. So especially from the 14th century onwards, the popes become really sort of increasingly adventurous in their claims to authority over sort of temporal political issues. So in 1308, Pope Boniface VIII wrote in his 1308 bull, the Unum Sanctum, said that basically the popes are possessed by two swords that were granted to them by God as the representatives of God on earth. One is spiritual power and one is temporal power. And since the popes couldn't be violent, they gave their sword, because they're priests, they gave their sword of temporal power to the Holy Roman Emperor, which means that the Holy Roman Emperor is the servant, not of God directly, but of the Pope. What that means is that if the Emperor is to... The Emperor serves at the disposition of the Pope. If the Pope doesn't like an Emperor, he can dismiss him. Now, the emperors have no interest in being the lackeys of the Pope, but you do see throughout the 14th century more and more and more interference in, or attempts by the Pope to interfere in imperial political affairs, which is the inspiration for the Golden Bull of 1356, which creates a constitution, basically, for the empire. It's an attempt to set out the rules, basically. So there is no ambiguity, there's no wiggle room, there's no way that, like, the popes can mysteriously and conveniently find another Roman document that says that they, I don't know, should get, like, their own Voltron mech suit and be able to stomp on, and be able to stomp all over Aachen. Like, We've talked about the Golden Bull already in the context of elections, but the truth is that formalizing election procedures is an incredibly important part of institutionalizing and expressing power when politics is unstable. Like, having an unwritten constitution is a luxury that very few countries even today can afford, because if you don't write down what the rules are, people are going to abuse them. And the increasingly bold and increasingly domineering papacy was absolutely willing to do that. And so saying, no, it's these seven guys, and you can have three of them, but most of them will not be bishops.
Yep.
Is a way of saying, yes, you have a role in this empire, but at the end of the day, It is the secular temporal leadership of the German aristocracy that is going to rule this empire. Being said and done, I think we should return to the original question that we posed at the start of this episode 100 years ago. Is the Holy Roman Empire holy, Roman, or an empire? Answers on a postcard.
Yes, yes, and yes. That's right, Voltaire. I saw your grave and I laughed. I did. It's a nice grave. It's in,
I think,
it's in Paris.
Oh, but mon ami, bonjour, it is me, the ghost of Voltaire. Explain yourself.
Me in this grave with Rousseau.
Show your working.
Well, okay, I think, of course it's all semantics, but I think to begin with, holy, well, for most of the empire's existence, it basically derived its legitimacy from the papacy, which I think makes it hard to remove the holiness aspect. Roman, I think, is almost a little bit redundant then in that context, because Rome is essentially synonymous with the papacy at this point. If you're asking, of course, whether it had, you know, a connection to the Roman Empire of classical antiquity, well, not particularly, no.
Well, not directly.
Not
but
directly.
Via the Byzantines, it absolutely did.
Well, exactly, yes. It wasn't like they just brought back Julius Caesar and, you know, conquering the Gauls and whatnot, but absolutely, yeah, you can draw that connection. And was it an empire? Well, what really is an empire?
I'll tell you. Do you want to actually know?
Yeah.
I mean, from a modern sort of political science point of view, an empire is a couple of things. It's a state that aspires to universality. Tick. It's multi-ethnic. Tick. Its political boundaries and political authority is based on sort of universal civilization rather than a particular culture. Tick. Its elite is cosmopolitan, being drawn from across the empire. Tick. And lastly, it's hierarchical. So the most important relationships are ruler to subject, not subject to subject. Again, tick. If you want to model for what that looks like, imagine the spokes on a wheel connecting the axle to the wheel itself. That's a good model for how an empire works. And again, tick. So I think the Holy Roman Empire absolutely hits all of the necessary criteria to be an empire, aside from the fact that, to be really blunt, in a medieval context, I think given the very particular medieval definition of empire, a state that claims to be that empire is pretty unique.
Yes.
So yes, I think it is. I think Voltaire is wrong. I think Voltaire can suck it.
Yes.
I really don't think that's very fair.
I've been saying this for years.
You know what? I'm gonna go. You people raised me from the dead just to shout at me.
Well, I think people get up in arms, if I may bring my own opinion in now. I think people get up in arms because we all have a conception in our minds of what the Holy Roman Empire is. And to be honest, a bunch of Germans kicking about in 13th century Burgundy doesn't really have anything in common with what we imagine the Holy Roman Empire, with what we imagine the actual Roman Empire to be. And
non.
So,
exactement.
A little bit like, you know, Pope Gregory, we just think, well, let's excommunicate them. Let's get rid of that.
And you know, I think to be fair to me, I was writing in the 18th century, okay? This is post-Reformation, a political event that tore the empire apart, that broke it up into Catholic and Protestant states, disrupting the authority and legitimacy of the central empire even more than it already was.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, you mentioned earlier, Aaron, not Voltaire, that, yeah, by the time it got around to the Habsburgs, they were basically just passing it around like a ceremonial token, the same way they were passing around their own genetic material to each other. And so I think that's also part of it, is that our last memory of any empire will always be the decline and the fall. And so I think it's natural that we remember the Holy Roman Empire as how it existed in modern Europe, not medieval Europe, and it was a much more ineffectual sort of declawed version of itself.
Are we? How can it be holy when it does not have a single faith? How can it be an empire when it cannot stop its different units from warring with each other? And how can it be Roman when Rome has disappeared for over 1,000 years?
You know what?
Well said, Voltaire. You should get you on more.
I'm starting to feel a bit more sympathetic to Voltaire.
Yeah, we've been very unfair to him by pretending he was talking about the medieval Holy Roman Empire. But in my defense, that's the only quote anybody knows.
Yep.
So
Exactly.
And plus, Voltaire was very nice about Edinburgh, so we're on...
Did you know it was formed on seven hills, just like Rome?
I did know that. That's why it's such a nightmare to cycle there.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for listening to yet another episode of the Weird Medieval Guys podcast.
Did you know that the Weird Medieval Guys podcast is neither weird nor medieval nor a podcast?
I don't know how many normal podcasts have, like, an extended bit with Voltaire. So, Olivia, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Weird Medieval, and I have a personal account at Olivia_MS.
Where you mostly just shout at the guy from Mountain Goats.
I wanted him to play Anglo-Saxons at the Roundhouse show last Wednesday, but he did not.
It was on theme, to be fair. They're medieval.
And where can people find you, Aaron?
I'm at Aaron P. Tappers on Twitter, and I'm at Aaron on Blue Sky. We also have a Discord, which we've completely neglected to promote for the last 2 months.
True, join the Discord. We'll link it in the notes, as I call them.
As everybody calls them.
As everyone calls them. Fun fact about this podcast, I have introduced the term schnotes to refer to show notes. That's it.
Thank you for one final exciting fact.
And if you enjoy this podcast, we would be absolutely over the moon with gratitude if you could give it a review on Spotify, a 5-star one if you think it deserves such a review. Tell your friends and family about it. Leave a little note for us in the little note box that says, what do you think about this episode? And maybe we will read that note out loud on the next episode of the podcast, just like we're about to do now.
We got this comment from somebody whose name is a bunch of numbers, so I'm not going to read them, who says, these intros are fucking amazing.
Thank you. We try so hard.
We really don't. We mostly just crack open a can of Strongbow and see where the night takes us. Well, I think it's time to bid adieu. Or how do you say goodbye in German, Olivia?
You say Auf Wiedersehen, which means until I see you again. Which is kind of nice, even though we can't see each other because this is a podcast.
Constantinople?
No.
Oh, fuck.
Ireland. Sorry, I shouldn't have said that in an Irish accent. It was a pretty good Irish pronunciation of Ireland, though. No?
It was all right. Don't push it. That also, it really works. Oh, fuck.
Ireland. Ireland.